It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska. One of Kodiak's four licenses that allow restaurants to sell beer and wine is up for grabs, and only one restaurant applied with the state to get it. KMXT's Davis Hovey reports.
In the name of economic development, both of Kodiak's municipalities have been trying for nearly 2 years to free up state licenses that allow restaurants to serve beer and wine. The city and borough even requested the state increase the number of licenses available. Every effort hit a dead end. Now, one of those coveted licenses is back on the table. The second floor restaurant, which closed prior to 2024, was not able to renew its license last year. Earlier this year, the downtown breakfast and lunch eatery Nuniak was the only business to apply for the license, according to the State Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. During the Borough Assembly's most recent meeting on May 7th, the Assembly unanimously decided to protest Nuniak's application. Assemblymember Bo Whiteside made the motion and says if Nuniak fixes an American Disabilities Act code violation, then the Borough Assembly could withdraw its objection.
We do have an ADA compliance issue that seems minor in nature.
According to the City of Kodiak's building official, the entrance ramp to Nuniak is not ADA compliant. Melissa Burns, the owner of Nuniak, told KMXT via email that construction on the entrance ramp will begin later this month. However, city staff say Nuniak's building permit to do the work from last year has expired. The city council also voted to protest Nuniak's license application, subject to rescission, during its meeting on April 23rd. Otherwise, Assemblymember Whiteside says he supports the license going to Nuniak.
There's clearly overwhelming support for this from their neighbors. I think it'd be great to have another license in our community. They're a fantastic asset to our downtown tourism and locals here alike. So hopefully if this small discrepancy can be addressed in a timely manner, the objection will be withdrawn.
Burns is slated to appear before the Borough Assembly on May 21st for an informal hearing on her license application. She told KMXT that serving beer and wine has been part of her business plan since she opened Nuniak in 2022. The State Alcoholic Beverage Control Board could make the final decision on Nuniak's license at its next meeting this summer. And for transparency, Borough Mayor Jared Griffin is also the general manager at KMXT. Per KMXT's policy, he does not have any editorial influence over news stories, and he did not review this story before it was aired. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Hovey.
The Alaska Legislature's regular session ends in just over 1 week, and lawmakers are racing to pass a wide range of bills and resolutions before the deadline. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone has been at the Capitol tracking what lawmakers are up to, and he spoke with Alaska News Nightly host Casey Grove.
So, Eric, what's in store for the last week of the session?
Well, Casey, it is going to be busy. This is the second year of a two-year legislature, so any bill that doesn't pass before that May 20th deadline dies, lawmakers would have to start all over again next year or whenever the next session is. More on that ominous suggestion in just a minute. But there are a few things to watch here. There are the budget bills, of course. Those are always a big deal because they encompass so much of what state government does, and the operating budget sets the amount of the permanent fund dividend. There's also the gas pipeline tax bill. Legislators are debating how much to subsidize the Alaska LNG project, and then there's what I'll call everything else.
Right, just the rest of all of that. First, though, let's dig into the budget bills.
Always a good place to start. So the operating budget, that's the big one. It's passed out of the House and out of the Senate. So now a conference committee is working out the differences. The House's budget has a $1,500 PFD and about $160 million in one-time funding for public schools, and also a deficit that would likely require spending more than $300 million from the state's main savings account. It also includes the revival of a state-funded heating assistance program, more money for childcare, early learning programs, and other social programs. The Senate's budget is far more conservative. conservative. It's built on a more modest forecast for oil prices for next year than the Department of Revenue predicted back in March. It includes $1,150 in payments to Alaskans. That is a $1,000 PFD and a $150 energy relief payment. It's enabled by high oil prices this year. It also includes up to $111 million in one-time funding for schools, plus another approximately $30 million specifically to help schools with high energy costs, though much of that depends on oil prices coming in higher than the forecast. And for now, prices have been a lot higher than the forecast, which was $91 a barrel for the rest of the fiscal year when they issued it back in March. Alaska's oil has been selling at a weirdly high premium to global benchmarks, lingering well above $100 a barrel since mid-March. And there's obviously a lot of uncertainty, though, around that, given the chaos in the Middle East. But as far as the budget goes, we'll start seeing where things land here pretty soon as the conference committee works out the final draft of it. And that's the operating budget. The capital budget, which funds longer-term infrastructure projects, has seen less debate. Most of the state general purpose money in that budget is devoted to school and state facility maintenance and upgrades, and that bill should be up for a final House vote soon. One quick thing on the third budget bill, the mental health budget. Senators added funding for homeless assistance programs to match an agency request that eliminated a cut that was proposed by the Dunleavy administration. The fourth and final budget bill, the supplemental budget, actually passed earlier this year.
Okay, so there we have all the budget bills. Let's talk about the gas line bill.
Yeah, Casey, this is the big one. So to boil it down, there's a large statewide tax on the books for oil and gas properties. It's 2% of the assessed value per year. Back in March, Governor Mike Dunleavy proposed replacing that property tax with a tax on pipeline throughput, which would vastly reduce the amount of state and municipal revenue from the project, but would also make the risky and complex project, you know, more attractive to investors. Now, a month and a half later, everyone seems to be on board with that so-called alternative volumetric tax as a concept. But what the tax rate should actually be and, you know, what conditions should be attached to that tax relief, basically, that's not something that is close to settled. The House Resources Committee approved a bill last week with a tax about 2.5 times what Dunleavy proposed. Now it's on to the House Finance Committee, and I've been listening in on those hearings, and honestly, a lot of lawmakers there are starting from square one. In the Senate, it's yet to pass out of its first committee, despite dozens of hearings. Senators seem reluctant to give up any state revenue to make the pipeline pencil out, and they're frustrated that they're being asked to make decisions without knowing key details like, you know, the most recent estimates for the cost of the whole project. So for now, leaders in the state House and Senate are doubtful they can get the bill done before the regular session ends. Meanwhile, though, Governor Mike Dunleavy says he's willing to call a special session on the issue, though he does insist there's enough time to get the bill through both chambers. Dunleavy has an hour after adjournment to call lawmakers back into an immediate special session. Otherwise, he'd have to wait 30 days. So this one is definitely one to watch as we get down to the wire.
All right. Now we're left with that third bucket. Everything else.
Yeah, it's a big bucket, Casey, because this is bill passing season. There's a crime bill. There's a package of 10 proposals rolled into one moving through the Senate. Among other things, it would raise the state's age of consent to 18, criminalize AI-generated child sexual abuse material, update laws on sexual assault by a healthcare worker, many others. That one is in the Senate Finance Committee right now and could head to the floor pretty soon. There's also a bill that would link eligibility for resident hunting and fishing licenses to PFD eligibility. That's now awaiting a vote in the Senate after passing the House earlier this year. And then lots of folks are anticipating a veto of a bill that would allow the state to once again offer its employees a pension plan. Lawmakers passed that late last month, and Dunleavy has to sign or veto it before lawmakers leave town, or it'll go into effect automatically. So you can expect movement on that in the closing days of the session. And there is so much more I wish I could get into, including a bill to make the giant cabbage the state vegetable, but I think we'll have to leave it there for now.
Hey, you know, some of us are watching that cabbage bill pretty closely, but, you know, thank you for catching us up on all those other, you know, arguably more important things. That was Alaska Public Media's state government reporter, Eric Stone. Eric, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
That was Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone speaking with Casey Grove. The public had many opinions about mining minerals on the seabed off Alaska's coast. The federal agency considering a first-of-its-kind lease sale closed its public comment period last month. Now it is reviewing the roughly 90,000 submissions. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management's seabed mineral proposal covers more than 113 million acres of federal offshore waters. That includes most of the Aleutian Islands, parts of the Bering Sea and Arctic Ocean, and parts of the Gulf of Alaska. The comment period originally closed March 2nd, but the federal agency extended it through April 1st. It drew what the Bureau calls a significant level of public participation, though the agency says it does not know if 90,000 comments is the most it has ever received. After reviewing the comments, the next step is called area identification. It's where the federal agency narrows down which specific areas, if any, move forward. There is no set timeline for that phase. Several more steps would follow before any lease sale could actually occur. Those include an environmental analysis where agency scientists study the potential impacts of mining in those areas. Spending in Alaska's U.S. Senate race is ramping up. The Democratic Senate Majority PAC says it's reserving $10 million of Alaska TV airtime for political ads. The group said by email that it will support Democrat Mary Peltola against Republican incumbent Senator Dan Sullivan. The announcement also suggested a possible theme would be rising costs and Sullivan's loyalty to President Trump. Reserving TV time isn't a binding commitment, but the group's announcement signals National Democrats believe they should invest in the Alaska race, and they think that Sullivan might be vulnerable. Campaign finance laws allow super PACs like Senate Majority PAC to raise and spend unlimited funds, but they aren't allowed to coordinate with a candidate's campaign. Typically, super PACs and other non-candidate campaigns air some of the harsher attack ads, leaving the candidates themselves free to run ads that project a positive image. The Democratic House Majority PAC announced last month that it plans to spend $2.4 million on ads in Alaska. Meanwhile, Republican National Committee says it's investing in the ground game ahead of November's midterm elections. The party says it's already deployed staffers to take Trump's message directly to Alaska voters. A spokesperson for the RNC wouldn't disclose how many people it has sent to Alaska, but did say more are on the way. A state judge in Anchorage has once again delayed a new election misconduct trial for former state representative Gabrielle Ledoux, Republican from Anchorage, after state prosecutors requested the postponement. Earlier this year, judges Catherine Easter and Thomas Matthews scheduled a new trial for June, but Judge Josie Garten agreed on May 1st to postpone the trial until the State Court of Appeals takes up a review requested by the state. Under the current briefing schedule for that review, a trial is not likely until fall at the earliest. In 2020, prosecutors accused Ledoux of 5 felonies and 9 misdemeanors in connection with the 2018 primary election, the 2018 general election, and the 2014 general election. They claimed Ledoux encouraged people to register to vote in her district despite not living there. The charges related to the 2014 election were dismissed as untimely. The remainder went to trial in November and December 2024, but that ended in a mistrial after jurors could not agree on Ledoux's guilt or innocence. After the mistrial, Ledoux and her attorney filed an appeal to challenge a legal definition that would be given to the jury. That issue is the definition of when a person establishes legal residence necessary to vote. Ledoux argued that a person who has bought a home within a district is eligible to register to vote there. The state argued that the person must actually be living within the home in order to register. On November 10th, Garten ruled in favor of Ledoux's interpretation of the law, thus striking down jury instructions that the state had sought. Prosecutors have since appealed Garten's rule to the State Court of Appeals, and both sides are now trading written arguments ahead of a possible oral argument on the matter. A new status hearing on Ledoux's case is scheduled for May 26th. The fire season in Anchorage is likely to be average, according to the Anchorage Fire Department. John Glover, chief of the department's wildfire division, says the risk is still high even during an average year.
We want to be really prepared as we get into those hotter and drier months, if we have them in the summertime.
Long hours of sunlight and wind can dry out the forested areas that make up the vast majority of Anchorage, increasing the potential for wildfires. In cities like Anchorage, Glover says, a small fire can create a big impact. Glover says the wildfire division will start clearing brush and thinning highly flammable spruce trees in July. The focus will be on areas where homes butt up against wild areas and residents have few evacuation routes. Last summer, the division worked on several similar projects in places like Campbell Airstrip Road and Hillside, but Glover says there's still a lot to do.
The bottom line is we went for about 15 to 20 years with almost no mitigation actions within the municipality. It's pretty hard to make up that gap. Those 8 to 12 projects that we're doing, that's just a start.
The city founded the Wildfire Division in 2024, partly in response to disastrous fires in the lower 48. The projects are funded with federal grants. Glover says the plan is to continue clearing out the underbrush and other fuel sources in strategic areas and to create a schedule to maintain the work. The division also has grant money for public outreach projects. Residents can sign up for a program called FireWise, which assesses the fire readiness of homes. Glover says having a plan is the most important thing to keep in mind.
Having your plan figured out, knowing what you're going to do, what your evacuation route's going to be, having your stuff ready to go in case you're going to be displaced, having an action plan for your kids if you're at work, that kind of a deal.
Anchorage has stood up a text alert system called Smart 911 to get information about wildfires and other disasters. And the Anchorage Wildfire Division website has a daily fire danger rating. Petersburg's annual Little Norway Festival, also known as Mayfest, is rapidly approaching. The multi-day event celebrates the town's deep Norwegian ties with cultural activities, community events, and Vikings and Valkyries roaming the streets. KFSK's Taylor Heckert reports.
Above Petersburg's Main Street, borough employees hoist up two large flags, one American and one Norwegian. The flags are one of many preparations the town is making ahead of Petersburg's 68th Little Norway Festival. The days of festivities celebrate 7. Mai, Norway's Constitution Day, which takes place on May 17th. It's a big event in the little town and brings a lot of visitors each year. The lineup of events is packed, ramping up Wednesday morning with an 80th birthday celebration for the Wooden Saner Symphony. Julie Anderson has been helping plan the festival and says there are many Mayfest staples returning to this year's lineup. Thursday will be the annual Little Norway Festival pageant inside the high school gym.
Leading with the stories that we have throughout the years and talking about the Little Norway Festival and the independence, the 7. Mai, why we're celebrating the May 17th. There's some groups that will be singing the national anthem, the Norwegian national anthem.
Also at the pageant, you'll see young dancers in traditional red and blue Norwegian clothing called bunads. The Norwegian American of the Year will also be named. Like last year's parade, this year's will take place at 5 p.m. on Friday on Petersburg's Main Street. If you're interested in joining in, just line up 15 minutes before. There won't be any kind of sign-up sheet. Anderson says there's only one classic event that won't be on this year's lineup.
The only thing that we have taken off the schedule is the drag comp. It's the tug-of-war pool. We're hoping to have it back again next year, but this year, just scheduling and everything, that'll be the only thing that I know of off the schedule.
The tug-of-war competition you just heard was from 2022. Even without the tug-of-war, there will be a lot to do and see, like fur-clad Vikings and Valkyries, the herring toss, the weighted sled pole competition, fish-holding contest, and more. Petersburg Chamber of Commerce Director Kelly Slavin says to keep an eye out for the Community Theater Troupe's play, which will have three showings. There'll be multiple Make It and Take It Rosemaling classes, and local musicians will be playing throughout the festival. Plus, she says there'll be some new food vendors to snack on this year, too.
Yeah, I mean, who doesn't love festival food? Nobody pays attention when you go down there. You can hit every booth.
She says she's most excited about the waffles on a stick. There are also lots of fundraisers and local vendors to check out. Both Slavin and Anderson say the festivities are a big opportunity to support locals in the small town. Here's Anderson again.
It's definitely enriching the community in many ways, not just culturally, but financially.
Yes.
For, you know, every type of group that, you know, would like to.
There are many, many more events to look forward to this week. You can find the full schedule of events online. In Petersburg, I'm Taylor Heckert.